Now let's talk about Joey Chestnut for our open here.
Let's talk Joey Chestnut.
How do you ban the one thing that people watch about competitive eating?
Money
and vegan dogs. It's all vegan dog, baby.
Yeah, so wait, he has a sponsorship with the ones that make the meatless hot dogs?
Yeah, and I bet he just slams those puppies. Like, I can just imagine this also works for his numbers. Because I bet if it's a hot dog without meat, I bet there's just less weight in there, and he can put them down.
If you think I want to watch a man slam a lima bean and a cauliflower meat salad, you've got another thing coming, because I need that hot dog to be made of parts of every animal in the animal kingdom made by God.
Jumping right into it, finals game four last night. What a game. Lots to talk about. I guess I'll just open it up to you guys. Overall thoughts on that game, because that was not what I was expecting to see.
That game doesn't matter. That game matters as much as the Washington Wizards playing the New Orleans Pelicans in game 38 of the NBA regular season. But it's just a lot more people watched and the commercials were a little bit better. Like, that's all that game is to me. It does not matter in the grand scheme of things. Celtics want to win at home. That's it.
I see. You know, but, okay, go Quinn goes first and then I'll pile on whatever you say, Quinn.
I was just going to say, I mean, in my opinion, as far as games when you're down 3-0 go, what can you do beyond what they did last night? I mean, when you're down, when you're in a hole like that, you want to see a game like that, you know?
You can always knock it down 3-0. It's a good strategy.
That's true. And I mean, the first thing I have in the notes here is, where the hell has this Mavs team been this entire finals? But, I mean, that's the most ideal game you can have when you're down 3-0. It's a statement game like that where you go in, you end up with the third highest point deficit in NBA Finals history. And you say, hey, we're not going down without a fight.
To pile on Seth with Quinn, I do think that this game is significant, because what I do understand what you mean, Seth, is that the game itself, I mean, we're 3-1, we're going back to Boston, and Boston has shown us nothing but utter dominance the rest of this series. However, I do think there was a distinct difference in the way that Dallas was able to pull away, especially in the first half. Obviously, the Celtics were missing shots that they're usually making, but what stood out to me in this game more than that was that the opportunities that Mavericks were getting that they weren't getting before. Part of that's the corner three opened up, and then the lob option opened up, and the defensive presence of, you know, role players like Derrick Jones Jr., PJ Washington, mm-hmm. they stepped up. Derek Lively, I think we're seeing him, the emergence of a star in Derek Lively. So without a doubt, if I'm a Mavericks fan and we're going to end up losing in six, which I'd still think we're headed to a Boston Finals victory, which is what Seth is saying. It's like, it's not going to mean anything. I would be really confident in, I'd be as confident as I could be moving forward because of the opportunities the Mavericks were to get offensively, and then the sort of like the what they were able to show defensively. I think that there was a sideline interview where Derek Lively said, like, we figured him out. And when I hear certain interviews, I believe him. And when I hear certain interviews, I don't believe him. Maybe this is just me begging for there to be more finals game, but I wish there was to be something to figure out about Boston. Although Boston shot 30% from the field. And so they were a brick house. And that also helps.
Out.
Well, yeah. So I have some notes here, and I want to talk first about the Mavs, because you can make two arguments here, obviously, that part of this was the Mavs coming in and making a statement, and part of this was the Celtics just looking abysmal on the field. I think both of those are discussions in their own right. So we'll start with the Mavs.
Field. Heisman Trophy winner Jason Tatum on that field, really making a difference out there.
My bad. 50. They had a 50-point lead at one point in the fourth. That's insane. And like I said, this is the third largest win in NBA Finals history. You know, what does this say about the Mavs and where they're at? Because a huge part of this was obviously Luka and Kyrie, but the rest of the team was contributing all night last night.
Sure, they could do it again. And it obviously, you know, it's good for the NBA, right? It's another game. It's more viewership. It's more money for the league. All of that is positive. But the reason why I said that this game matters as much as any other random regular season NBA game is because if they had this performance and also had just one different performance in those first three games where they got one win and the series is 2-2, we are fascinated by this series. But instead, Quinn, I'm bored. I'm going to remain bored because this was just another blowout, but it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Every single year, I constantly hear the NBA or ESPN try to hype up, oh, will this team be the first ones to come back from a 3-0 series deficit? No. No, they won't. No one's going to do it. Stop talking about it. The only team that's going to do it is one that isn't talked about.
Someone has to do it.
No one will ever do it.
In the statistical model of the bell curve, when you're on the absolute outlier part of the bell curve, you're never at zero. Someone has to do it. It might just be one person, but it's going to happen. A part of me, this is me begging the NBA, my NBA fandom, to continue just for a few more days. Maybe I get a few more games out of this. What I'm hoping is that I saw Dallas get opportunities that were different than Boston losing opportunity. Like Boston's defense started the game similar to similar in the first quarter than to what we've seen, but it was Dallas's offensive ability to overcome Boston's defense that was what gave them part of this big lead. So it's not necessarily Boston losing it. I feel like this was Dallas winning it, which sort of makes me think that there could be some significance that leads us to a game six. Let me tell you, it could be six, but I said this before on the last podcast. If we, the NBA fans, wanted this not to be a total blowout by the Celtics, and we've actually seen this before as NBA teams blowing out other teams, and then the next game, it's a blowout in the opposite direction. A big part of that is the variance of three-point shooting.
Sure.
If you're able to hit 40% of your three-pointers and you're putting up 30 or 40 shots, I mean, that's just an enormously significant amount of points, statistically speaking. Not to get all statistics on you guys, so I'll stop it there. But the point I really want to make is that I do think that Dallas figured something out that I think will show up. I think that my prediction is that when we start watching game five, what we're going to start watching is two evenly matched teams playing on Boston's court. I don't think we see another blowout in that way.
So sure, to Connor's, sure. But to all Connor's I'm saying, note, all I'm saying is that a 16 seed will never beat a 1 seed in the men's NCAA tournament, a man will never walk on the moon, and a team will never come back from 3-0 in an NBA playoff series. These are
your old age, I'm absolutely
confident about.
Your old age is you're wearing it like a crown, like a silver crown of wisdom, although I disagree. I'm in the new age of anything's possible, baby. Anything's possible.
Rob. So, Connor, I mean, you were talking about the bell curve, and you're saying eventually it has to happen. But is this Mavs team capable of being that team against this Celtics team?
Great question, Quinn. I think the what if I were, let's say they're down 3-0, and I'm saying, okay, what would it look like for a team to come back from 3-0? Like, what is the path forward for a hypothetical team like that? The first game of 3-0, I would say, well, you're going to have at some point such a large blowout. The team comes back to the locker room and they can say, okay, we're not out of this. Like, we're not out of this. Winning by 40, I'm able to go back to the locker room and saying, like, listen, they're beatable. Okay. And in the NBA, especially with, as we're seeing, like our conversation on, you know, last week's episode, as we're seeing the depth of the NBA rise, we're actually seeing a lot more variance in from series to series, which means it's just so hard to sweep a team. It's never been harder to sweep a team than it has been in today's NBA. And it's not like this is Golden State and the Cleveland in the 2010s on just a direct path to each other every single season. I mean, what we're seeing is we're seeing Denver lose in the second round. You know, that's the previous champs of the last season. And then they lose to a team. And then Minnesota ends up losing to Dallas in five. So it's just hard. It's just hard to beat a team in four games. But if I am to see a team bounce back, the bounce back is going to look like something as significant as that game. To me, that game is filling Dallas with as much confidence as you can. Like, let's say if I'm in the head of Jason Kidd, head coach of Dallas Mavericks, I'm saying, okay, guys, we're going to go home. You're down 2-0. You're heading home. He's like, we have to obviously pick up two games. And if we can't, we're picking up one game. And 3-1 series, people have come back from this before, you know? So all you need is the confidence that it's possible. And I'm telling you, I couldn't be more confident if I was. I could be, but given the circumstance, I couldn't be. If I'm a Dallas Mavericks fan, Luka Doncic. If I'm Luka Doncic, I need to get some ice on that knee, man. He looks like he's hobbled. Keep going. All right, that's that. That's that.
Well, I mean, I kind of alluded to it at the beginning of the podcast, but I mean, I'll agree with Connor here. I mean, if you're going to come down from a 3-0 deficit from a hole as big as the hole that they were in, you know, you need to make a statement win like you had last night. You need to have a game where you're going out there and you're creating the third largest deficit in NBA history, finals history. You need to go out there. You need to make the other team, A, look like absolute fools on the court, which they did. And you need to, B, make yourselves look like the dominant team, the team that should have won. And like I said, I still think, you know, Celtics in 5-6, but their path there is a whole lot less certain than it was going into last night. Because I think going into last night, all three of us were thinking we were going to be on this podcast this morning talking about the entire series in review.
No, you're absolutely right. And I mean, the main thing that is paving that path and the road to what Connor is talking about, which you're right. I crap on the 3-0 series lead thing. And I do fully believe that the Celtics are going to get game five tonight, but if there is a road, it's through everyone that isn't just Kyrie and Luka making more of a difference, right? Two things are true at the same time right now in this series. The Dallas Mavericks have outscored the Boston Celtics despite being down 3-1. The other thing that's true is that five Boston players are outscoring everyone not named Luka Doncic and Kyrie Irving on the Dallas Mavericks. That is a trend that turned a little bit last night, obviously with such a massive blowout win, and you get to play more of your people, and just everything was working better, and the defense and all that jazz. But that is a trend that absolutely has to last three more games if the Mavericks are going to do anything here, because I don't know if Luka has three more performances in him like that. We're talking an even bigger step up possibly in some ways than the one that they had in
they're
the most
not
recent
letting
game.
On to it, but this dude is hobbling through the finals on
watch him play defense
knee. I mean, during the regular season he'd be out 100%. So But I mean, the fact that you're able to make that impact when you're in that situation, I mean, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, I agree, Quinn. You know, I think that Luka's greatness is always on display. He's at a level, right? He's playing at such a high level right now that you can tell that the consistency series to series, game to game, season to season, now we're seeing him at probably around his max powers, which is like, I can put up 30 points a game. I can get a triple double if I need to. I can be a passer if I need to. I can be a scorer if I need to. So he's playing really dynamically. So this is something that Seth was talking about, is what do you need if you're Dallas? Obviously, you need Luka and Kyrie to keep up at their pace, which is the design of the team. But if I'm Dallas, this is what I'm looking for moving forward. The Porzingis injury was huge because of the length of the Dallas Mavericks. It opens up the door for Daniel Gafford and Derek Lively, both to get rebounds and to be doing putbacks and to be getting defensive opportunities. They get shot blocking. I mean, what we saw in game one and two, Porzingis's length completely shut down Dallas's length. And that's because not only do you have Kristaps shutting down the big guys, but you also have Jaylen Brown, you have Jason Tatum, you have Derek White, you have huge wing defenders that are able to pick up Kyrie and Luka and honestly work them to the bone. And so I think that if I am Dallas moving forward, you're going to be really interested in seeing two different things. You're going to be interested in seeing how your length continues to perform with the injury of Kristaps Porzingis, which is significant. And I do think that could lead to more Dallas wins. That was huge. About, you know, think about how many times we saw Derek Lively just tip the ball out. It was counted as a rebound, but really there was no one able to get that rebound. He tips the ball out to the 3-point line. Luka's waiting there, right? Luka's waiting there with his walker. He sets his walker aside, grabs a basketball, takes two dribbles. You know, it's because he's so hobbled. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is the role players of Dallas stepping up. So it's clear that the design of the team is Luka and Kyrie. They're going to be the main offensive outputs of their success. And that's how it has worked. That's how Dallas worked when Luka was playing with Jalen Brunson. I mean, it was two scorers who were primary ball handlers who could share the ball, work off each other, spread the floor around to outside shooting. The outside shooting for Dallas has been below lackluster. I mean, it's been abysmal. So PJ Washington, Derek Jones, I don't know who else, Dante Exum. I'm looking at players who need to be at least 7 to 8 points, 2 to 3 threes to support Luka and Kyrie. That's not what we saw in the first two games. And it's a little bit of what we saw in the third game. But when you chart Dallas's success to this point, you see the rise of Derek Lively. You're seeing the rise of PJ Washington. You're seeing Derek Jones play above his capacity. So you actually have a lot of issues with Boston's depth beating Dallas's depth. And what we saw in game four was that Dallas's depth was able to get through. They broke through and they were able to score. And that might just be a one-off game, like Seth is saying. But what I'm hoping it is Dallas having figured out some critical piece that helps them go all the way, you know, maybe game six. I don't know. We'll see how far they can go.
That contribution sets a statement. It sets a tone. And if you have depth players coming in and contributing, not to the level, obviously, of Luka and Kyrie, but, you know, getting up there, you're going to have a lot easier time than you had in games 1, 2, and 3 of this. Seth, if you want to say something, go for it. But I was going to transition to talking about the Celtics, if that's okay.
No, absolutely. I think we've touched the points.
Because as much as a big part of this was the Mavs coming out and looking great last night, it's impossible to talk about this performance without talking about how abysmal the Celtics looked. I think JJ Redick said it best in the post game. He said, "This looks like a bad impersonation of the Boston Celtics team we've seen all year." This could very well be the worst performance they had on the court this season.
Have you guys ever had like a bad dream or just like imagined while you're watching sports that like, what if me and Jason Tatum like transported bodies right now and everyone thought that I was Jason Tatum and like I'm having to put up threes and everyone's like, oh, that looks like Jason Tatum, but I know that I'm not Jason. That's kind of what the Celtics look like, is if the three of us were put in their bodies and we're like, oh yeah, we're professional basketball players in the NBA finals in the biggest game of our lives. That's just a little reminiscent of how I felt about that performance.
Couple that of happened stats in Space Jam. I have in here. They were 3 for 9 on open look for field goals. They were 84 points in game 4 was the lowest this postseason. It was their third worst deficit ever as a team in 737 franchise playoff games. They were shooting 36%. This was just not the Celtics team that we've seen for the rest of the finals. What happened?
It's a great question. What I think happened first and foremost is that the Celtics were unable to shoot the ball from range, right? I'm reading right here, 34% from 3 points. They've actually shot the ball in this very poorly in the finals. We haven't really seen Boston shoot the ball from outside very well. I think their best shooting performance was probably game 3. And so we're seeing the Celtics not be able to execute offensively on the perimeter. That's them. I think when you go into Boston's ability to drive and kick, you're seeing Dallas with an all-time defensive performance as far as switching. And this is what Doris Burke was saying in the broadcast, but it was Dallas's ability to switch on defense and just go into scramble mode, you know, and just pick up every loose shooter, which is, you're just gonna have to be that desperate, right, when you can't afford to lose any other games. And so I would say they're shooting terrible, and when they drive, they're getting hit on the inside, and that's because, you know, you're missing the length of Kristaps Porzingis. That injury is significant because it actually opens up a negative and a plus for Dallas, right? Because it actually opens up their length, which they're able to use on a Jason Tatum drive, on a Jaylen Brown drive. And that's why the Celtics have been forced to shoot so much from three-pointers. They put up 41 three-pointers. They put up 41 shots, right? So they're putting them up, but yeah, they only hit 14 of them, you know? And this is also in a garbage time game. So the stats are going to be a little bit slanted because from the full fourth quarter is backup dudes. The whole third quarter is a shell-shocked Boston team. And so what's going wrong, I think, is the length of Dallas is finally doing something, and they're just playing desperate, man. They're just playing desperate on defense.
We joke about go ahead.
I was just going to bring up something that Joe Mazzulla said in the postgame because it goes well with what Connor said. I mean, that postgame interview, I'm not sure if either of you guys watched it. I was on an airplane, so I had nothing else to do. The entire time, there was media kind of fishing for the answer that they were looking for. And you could tell they were looking for a comment that said, we just didn't go out there. We didn't play our best game. We didn't, you know, that sort of thing. All he was doing was crediting the Mavericks for playing a great game. And he sounded so unbothered that they just won lost a game in the fashion that they did. To me, that speaks to where their headspace is at, because they know that while this game was bad, it was, you know, like Connor said, you were playing a garbage game at the end, you know, you weren't, you know, nothing mattered by the fourth quarter.
That's part of why my attitude is so strongly that this game does not matter, because of the confidence of the Boston Celtics, and particularly their leader, their coach. There's always the joke of, oh, you know, they lost game 4 so that they could go home and win it. And that's funny, but I think that there is a weird mental level of truth to that, even when someone isn't aware of it in how they're playing. It's hard to keep that edge of like, we got to keep foot fully on the gas when we're up 3-0, and everyone who's ever, you know, been involved with the NBA to the level that any of these players are fully aware of the statistic that no team has ever come back from a 3-0 deficit. The amount of confidence that you have, even when you're losing by 50 and sitting on the bench, you're like, yeah, we're just going to go home and we'll do it there. Like, I think that this team obviously wanted to win that game, but I don't think that they wanted to win it in the same game in the same way that they wanted to win games 1 through 3. And so I'm just not worried.
But how bad does this put, like, I mean, obviously I agree with Seth's point, but like, does this put them in a bad position going into game five, having a loss in the fashion they did?
Here's what's really exciting about basketball is that game five will start 0-0.
I think it's better for Dallas than it's worse for Boston when we're thinking about the mentality of both teams. So Boston, they're going to say, forget about it, flush it, which is what all basketball teams are doing across the length of a very long 82-game season. Like, you are good at shooting a ball. You're good at striking out, right? Like, that's part of the mentality of professional sports. It's like, you know what it is to fail and then to bounce back like nothing happened and to completely compartmentalize it away. But if you're Dallas, you're letting this put flames up your ass, and you're saying that we are going to go into Boston and we're going to do the exact same thing. So as opposed to it being negatively mentally, like a mental block for Boston, I think what this is just confidence for Dallas, which they desperately needed, especially going into a very difficult arena to play in. Being the away team in Boston, especially with finals game, not easily done. Not easily done. So I think that we're going to see a significantly improved Dallas Mavericks team in the first quarter of game five. If they come out of that first quarter, game's close, Dallas is going to keep on rolling. That first quarter of the next game, to me, is a bridge of what happened this game and what's going to be the story for the next game. I think when you see the way that both of these teams come out, there's either going to be Boston's, I mean, I'm hoping, and what I expect is that it's actually going to be a very close matchup because of Dallas's ability and their confidence match with Boston probably just not sucking as much. But the story is going to be in the first quarter with how both teams come out in game five, which has always been the case. I mean, you know, we're seeing a lot of blowouts in today's playoffs in the NBA. And like I said, that was because of the depth. And so I do think that to avoid a similar circumstance, you're going to have to see both teams come out with brand new mindsets, brand new strategy. And what I feel like in my gut, which might just be me wishing, is that Dallas found some level of strategy that could interrupt what Boston's been trying to do. I would say the first thing that happened is Boston came out flat and they were turning the ball over. You know, so you're having dumb turnovers where one guy's going right, the other guy passes the ball left. You're having you're having a lot of trouble when they're driving to the paint as well. Right now I'm seeing Tatum and Brown are the only two starters who shot free throws, which is part of the design, right? They want to do a very spread out game. They want to be launching a bunch of three-pointers, the Boston Celtics, but you're just not seeing anyone else get to the line. You're not seeing anybody else crowd the paint. So I think what went wrong is that Boston came out flat. They shot the ball terrible. They didn't make it to the free throw line. They had a bunch of turnovers. And to fix that going into the next game, what you're going to see Boston do is you're going to see probably a healthier dose of the role players. You're going to see a healthier dose of Derek White. You're going to see a little bit more Drew Holiday. And I think that's going to try to be opening up some breathing room for Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum to get going. Because also the two stars came out. And when I say they came out flat, I mean they came out flat. Jaylen Brown shot 3 for 12, right? Wow. We're talking a brick factory on planet brick in galaxy brick Ixia. You know, we're talking bricks universe here. And so what I want to say is that it's Dallas's defense that caused this to happen. But what we all understand about, especially the NBA at this level, is that coming into game five, you got to get your role players going to open up some space for your stars, and then your stars need to take over in the second half. That's what you need to have happen if you're Boston.
I think if Boston wins the first quarter by 5 or more, series is over. Because I think that Connor's point is absolutely huge of the momentum of that quarter is going to decide where are we picking up? Where did we leave off? And if it is with the Mavericks doing well, I think even if the Mavericks are winning by 5 or 7 at the end of the first quarter, I don't think it's series over, because Boston has proven time and time again, just not last game, that they can adjust extremely well to a variety of different situations and to deficits. I think with home court advantage and with just the complexity of that Boston team, if they get an early lead, I don't see a way that Dallas can kind of maintain that momentum that they got going in game four. I think it's a quick end to it because they will be reminded, oh yeah, that score doesn't carry over into this game. Like, then you start playing desperate in a way that's less beneficial for your team, right? It's not like, wow, we got to win this game. It's, oh no, we can't lose. And that's when you start playing scared and you don't,
that's when you lose by 40.
That's why like, he was by 40.
Like, there were two the other desperate to Dallas team is like they're so desperate they're gonna kill you, and then Boston's so desperate they're gonna get themselves killed. You know.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, is there anything else to talk about with the final? What are you guys' predictions for what we see the rest of the series? I think that's a good place to go.
I would say I'm a little bit on the opposite side of the spectrum as Seth in this case. What I see happening in the next game is Dallas coming out strong. I think it's going to be a much closer game, but I do think that Dallas comes out and actually wins, and it gets us to a game six wherein anything could happen. I think Boston in six is still a really good, if I'm a betting man, I'm betting that game, I'm betting that series. But I do think that this was such a significant win. I do think Dallas is able to actually pull out maybe one more if they're able to get their bench guys going.
Interesting, guys. Connor. What a change you have from last week. Wow. It's almost like you have no backbone.
No, I said on the podcast, I said someone needs to get injured. I had interrupted Quinn. You can go back. And someone did get injured, and it was Kristaps, and it completely changed the way that you see Boston's length going.
No, you're absolutely right.
I didn't
right.
change.
Yeah.
His tendons changed. So. Right.
Yeah, they changed position in his body.
Yeah. So.
I'm still strong on that game five. Game five finish from Boston. I think that they're at least gonna keep the beginning of the game either close or they're gonna take a lead. And I don't think the Mavericks have the mental fortitude to respond. Definitely not three more times in a row, but I don't think that they can do it in Boston's very hostile environment. So still, Boston in five from me.
Did you say four last week?
I said four or five.
I think
yeah, and we always do this, you know, we're always saying, oh, maybe five games, maybe six games. But when you watch a win like this, oh, it gets me feeling, I'm starting making plans. I'm like, well, I can watch that game at my mom's house with a big TV, maybe game seven, I'll be in a bar, be kind of fun. I'm already making plans, dude.
Yeah, I'm trying to do a better job of keeping track of our takes so that we can do aged like milk. So I'm writing down everything that we're saying so that we can make fun of each other later.
I think Celts in five. I think they take it in the next game. I mean, I respect what the Mavs did on the court, but now it's Boston's turn. And the team that we've seen throughout the entire playoffs, you know, is the team that we're going to see in game five again. You don't have a team like that just go away completely. So Celts in five, I think we see this wrap up Monday night. And next week, we talk only baseball.
Woo! That's right.
Okay, let's talk tinfoil hat takes. I got one. I don't know if you guys came prepared with one. But my tinfoil hat take is that Juan Soto, at the end of this year, when he becomes a free agent, deserves a larger contract than Shohei Ohtani.
Explain yourself, because this is such a bad take.
Conspiracy. So I want you to put the X-Files music over every take, like, because it's tinfoil hat.
So Shohei Ohtani, an incredible player. And I'm not going to discount what he has done as a part of this, because Shohei Ohtani deserved the contract that he got. Albeit he is injured, and it's you know, whether he pitches to the same caliber that we saw prior to him signing this contract remains to be seen. But I want to talk about Juan Soto. This dude has been incredible. Since he joined the league, he has led the league in at least the top three, don't quote me on this because I don't have the stats in front of me, of on-base percentage every single season. This guy is the real deal, you don't see players like this in the MLB anymore. This is Barry Bonds level of on-base percentage. This is Barry Bonds level of batting average, maybe not slugging percentage. And in Barry Bonds' prime, he was damn near untouchable. But Juan Soto is perhaps the best offensive player in the game right now. And that bat, that tool, will serve you well. And his tools to get on base at the click that he does are going to age very well. You can have a 35-year-old Juan Soto on your team, and he's still going to be getting on base with that eye that he has. He's going to be getting walks. He's going to be drawing out pitch counts. He's going to be a valuable member of your team. He deserves $750 million in free agency this year.
Woo.
Wow. Wow. All of those are great points. He's not two people in one people. That's all I have to say. Shohei Ohtani is two people, but he's one people.
But and I would so argue
because that, of the amount of people,
I would argue that the value he brings comes in his longevity and in what he's able to do at the plate. Because Shohei Ohtani, as good as he is, a pitcher and a hitter, may not be able to do that into his late 30s. But a player like Juan Soto, who's able to do that behind the dish, can do that until he's 38, you know, with no problem. So signing him to a 13-year deal into his late 30s is a lot less risky. And if you give him, like I said, $750 million, 13-year deal, it's completely justified.
Interesting. Yeah, that becomes an interesting...
That's a great take. Great take. Yeah.
It's an interesting quandary of would you rather have one guy who's two guys for 7 years or one guy who's really good at being one guy for 13 years?
I'd probably go one guy for 13 if that is the only metric I get. Because
you're right.
I don't, again, like Shohei, there's no way he can continue pitching, right? And not injure his hitting.
Yeah.
Right? Like, can a human body do that? I didn't know a human body could do it until he got to the pros, so maybe his can.
I'm hearing is Connor agrees with me. You're wrong.
I'm always on the side of give players $250 million. Give it to them. It's very hard. Professional sports is very hard. Have all of the money.
I'll do my tinfoil hat take. Let me pull it up with the exact wording. Okay. I actually want to bring a sport that we've never talked about into the pod, and I think we should have a more full episode about this one of these days. But my tinfoil hat take is about the WNBA. So my tinfoil hat take is the WNBA will see a steep drop in television viewership during its second month of the season. I am not happy about this take, but I'll give you some brief backup of why I feel this way. So last season of the WNBA averaged 462,000 viewers per game. This season, so far, after the first month, the WNBA released that they averaged 1.32 million viewers per game. So essentially tripling their viewership in just a season, which is fantastic. However, every single day, the WNBA shoots itself in the face with how it decides to cover and display itself in the media. And it's kind of becoming laughable at this point because you have some of the best momentum that a sport has gotten in the past 20 years when it comes to marketing and media coverage. And something that we've been pushing for in women's sports for a long time for people who have been following women's sports is that the reason why it should be watched is because of the hype of it, because of the athletic prowess, because it's entertaining to watch, not because it's some sort of charity event or you should be guilted into watching or you should watch it for the politics of it, which we've now accomplished with the brilliance of a lot of these rookies coming in, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, Caitlin Clark heading that list of names, but also including Cameron Brink on the Los Angeles Sparks and Angel Reese. And even, you know, we've got rookies on the go Seattle, baby. Seattle Storm.
Come on, Storm. Give them hell. Give them hell, baby. Come on.
Go team. And so it's drawing attention to a lot of those players and also the stars who have been in the league for quite a few years. And I think the NBA or the WNBA is kind of going to lose some of that in this coming month because they've brought up all of this hype. They've set a really high standard, but yeah. Then they've made 22-year-old Caitlin Clark this, you know, personality and asking her to speak on topics and to constantly kind of be this voice that she's not asking to be. And also just kind of covering the, oh, she got fouled really hard today. And these players had these not nice things to say about her. And well, you're taking the face of your brand and you're making them less likable.
I also think that we've seen a lot of manufactured controversy around her.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, you see things, and I'm not going to disagree with what you're saying, Seth. I don't even know. I mean, we're doing tinfoil hat takes here, but I don't know that it's all that controversial. Not to discredit the fact that you brought it into tinfoil hat takes, but you know, but I mean, I agree with you. I mean, you've created a brand around this individual who is the real deal. I mean, for what it's worth, but how sustainable is that? When does the novelty of that wear off, and when do you need to pivot to making sure that you're marketable in other areas? And as much as I do love what's going on and I love seeing them gain this relevance, I think they need to figure out a way to market their talent that it just, hey, look at Caitlin Clark, finally in the WNBA, not in college basketball, ever watch these games.
You know? Yeah. Really, I don't think that, you know, my take about, there being some dislikable media coverage or, like you're saying, the manufactured drama. I don't think that that's too hot of a take. But what I'm saying specifically is I think that that will not have the WWE effect that I think that they want it to have, which is more viewership for the drama. I think people are going to get tired of it very quickly. Again, they tuned in for sports. They tuned in for elite athletes like Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese and all these other WNBA players being fun to watch on the court. And instead, I think they're now getting a very different product. And you're seeing that in a lot of the responses from fans of we're a month in and they're tired of it. So I think that is specifically why the viewership is going to go down.
Anybody got
I think it's a fantastic take. I mean, a fantastic take. I just quick note, Quinn, if you don't mind. Quick note, because I want to make a point about what it means to be a basketball star now as opposed to what it means to be a basketball star, let's call it in the 90s, right? We're talking 30 years ago, maybe even in the 80s. So David Stern, commissioner of the NBA, brought the NBA to its prominence using Larry Bird and using Magic Johnson, particularly when the Celtics and Lakers were going head-to-head. So there's the beginning of a league is built on talent. And it's built on wins and it's built on championships. And then you work backwards from there. The WNBA is kind of trying to go forwards with their messaging on Caitlin Clark, where they're saying, we're going to start with someone who hasn't won, she's won, but at the college level. So she hasn't won at the right level. So it's like, and we're going to treat her as a controversial figure. We're going to make her the center of all of our conversation in a 24/7 news cycle, predominantly built on controversy and predominantly built on how many clicks can you get. And that's hard because you're using someone with a tiny sample size to cover hours and hours and hours of television. That's going to exhaust everyone. There's just nothing to talk about, especially if they're not winning, you know? So if I'm the WNBA, you wait for her to start winning before you say she's next up. You treat her like the NBA treats Anthony Edwards, but they're treating her from a media perspective, probably because people are just clicking on these. They're just clicking on it. They're treating her like she is LeBron James, right? Which is the center of all conversation and controversy. She's not ready for that yet. Like her status as a career, you know, a tenured individual, you have to treat her like Wembanyama at most. You know, which is like potentially the future of the league, but we're not there yet. We're not going to read into everything she says as some political statement one way or another. But the WNBA, they're reacting to her college season, and I think with Seth, that like I agree with them that that might fade over time, and so that just goes to show. I think if I'm building a brand, you start with championships and you work backwards.
We got a couple extra points here. Connor has a zinger of a hot take.
I got a zinger.
Okay.
Zing me, dog.
I stay on the zingers. Question, would you prefer a tinfoil hot take about a player, or would you prefer a tinfoil hot take about a league, a sports league?
I want your most, I want your take that is closest to a Stephen A. Smith take. I want your take that is controversial for the sake of being controversial, Connor, and I want to hear you defend it with your heart.
Connor, I want to feel like warm inside because I'm getting angry at you for your take.
You want to be boiling? I'll get you boiling, Seth. Let me get you boiling. The winner of the AFC South next season is the Pittsburgh Steelers, not the Bengals, not the Ravens, not the Browns, the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Why?
The AFC South, or the AFC North, the AFC North.
Who That's is? Why it's funny to me. The take isn't funny to me. It's funny because you said AFC South.
Yeah. AFC North, AFC North. Okay. I know what the South is.
I thought your take was going to be an organizational like reshuffling, and they were going to put Pittsburgh Steelers.
Never. No. The AFC North. The winner of the AFC North is going to be the Pittsburgh Steelers. I know who's in the AFC South. I know, and that's going to be won by the Texans, by the way. But the winner of the AFC North is going to be a team from Pittsburgh led by Russell Fountain of Youth. Wilson, baby. It's been 4 long years since we've done these podcasts. In those 4 years, no one has been shit upon more than Russell Wilson. And I mean no one. Like, this dude has become public enemy number 1. Everyone hates this guy. It's crazy. I grew up and I watched him win a Super Bowl in his second season with Seattle, and I said, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to put all of my love on one person. I'm going to marry him in sports. I'm going to sports marry him. I'm going to sports love him for the rest of my life. And that has not been easy the last 4 or 5 years. He has been dorky. He has taken money. He has lost a lot of games. He has articles coming out about him as a terrible leader. And nonetheless, he is going to lead Pittsburgh to a division title in the coming season with a fountain of youth in the body, new head coach, new setting. Pittsburgh, you got the terrible towel flying around all the time. Baltimore, probably going to be super injured like always. Bengals, underperforming because players want too much money. And Cleveland, bad karma from Deshaun Watson. Boom, you put that in a little ball and you shake it, and a Mike Tomlin's the best coach in the AFC North hot take bubble. You shake it up. And you got the Pittsburgh Steelers coming out with 11 wins and a division title, led by Russell Wilson.
Connor, the you goat. Are so passionate about this that I'm not even going to try and argue with you. I just want you to have this
Pittsburgh
one, buddy.
With 11 wins.
I want you to be right just for this reason. I want the Steelers to win the division after every other team in that division gets super injured, but it's after they go 0-3 to start the season, and Russ is just like 6 picks in 3 games, and they're like, Justin Fields, come on out, and he just has a Lamar 2019 unbelievable streak where he's just
he's found his home. Here's what it is. It's a fly sweep. You got Russell Wilson under center, hikes the ball. Justin Fields from the wide receiver position, boom, runs behind him. Russell pitches to Justin. Justin takes the ball to the sideline, throws it back to Russell. Russell catches the ball. Who's waiting in the end zone? Some wide receiver on the Steelers. I don't know who's left. Russell.
No one.
Bombs it. He bombs it to someone, you know? And that's gonna be the offense. And so I think, yeah, I think Steelers are coming in and they're coming in hot, and it's because my guy found the fountain of youth and he's going to be back and he's going to shove it up everyone's butt.
That's a great note. Not to only end it on, so.
All right. Yeah. Whatever.
That's all we have time for this week, unfortunately.
I can't believe I called up the AFC South. I can't believe that.
Hey, that's okay. We all make mistakes.
Your ethos,
buddy.
Connor. Your ethos.
Fuck. My ethos. Fuck.
That's all we got time for this week. What a great take, though, by Connor. We'll see if that one ages like fine wine by the end of the NFL season. It will not, but I want it to happen now.
Fountain of Youth!
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you guys next week on GPS Sports.